السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين. أما بعد، I'd like to thank you first of all for giving up at least a portion of your Saturday to come and join us, and ask Allah Azza wa Jal that we all benefit from the information and that He helps us apply this knowledge inshaAllah. The first things I would like to comment on, which is typically what I begin with, is the title of the workshop. And sometimes I get a lot of objections. People tell me, how is it that you claim to be able to do this in 10 minutes, while the Prophet ﷺ took 23 years? How dare you? 10 minutes versus 23 years. And I can sit here? And the response, of course, is that the Prophet ﷺ didn't take 23 years to get one shahada. The Prophet ﷺ took 23 years to convert the entire Arabian Peninsula. But the Prophet ﷺ, if you look at his seerah, many times he would speak to some people just a few sentences, a few words, and they come into Islam. So he had many shahadas, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, under 10 minutes. Now, of course, we don't really give anyone a shahada. That's a colloquial term that at least we use in the US, where you say, I gave him a shahada, or he took his shahada. Realistically, what happens, you witness people taking, you know, or reciting or saying their shahada. But this has become just a colloquial term. So when we say how to give a shahada, meaning how to present someone and get him to accept Islam. But the reality is, we do not want to mislead anyone into thinking that after you sit through this for a couple of hours, everyone you speak to for 10 minutes, mashallah, immediately will become a Muslim. So brother, just give me 10 minutes of your time, you'll see what will happen inshallah. That's not the case. Because we know very well from the hadith that some of the prophets of Allah Azza wa Jal will come forth on the Day of Judgment with only a handful of followers. And some prophets will have just a few men following them, and there will be prophets of Allah alone on the Day of Judgment with no followers. So we're not saying that it's guaranteed that you'll become, you know, like an instant da'iyah. Everyone you touch becomes a Muslim immediately. But what I'm trying to offer here is a quick and efficient way to get a shahada. So the question is, why those words? Why quick and efficient? And the answer is that da'wah generally, a lot of times, it's characterized by having little time. You don't have enough time to take everyone you know. So suppose you have a co-worker. You don't have time to take them to Jum'ah prayer to see how it is. Then you take them to the masjid for an event, for speeches. Then you take them to your local kebab place. And then you take them and read Qur'an with them. And then you read Bukhari with them. And then inshallah in the end they might become Muslim. But now the question is, how many times can you duplicate this? How many times can you do that? What if you're in a store, someone asks you a quick question about Islam. You have a 10-minute window. Can you present Islam to them in the best way in this 10-minute window? And convincingly enough so that they can even become Muslims. And where we are from, it's very common. You'll be walking into a store, someone will ask you something about Islam. A few minutes later, they're accepting Islam. Recently, one of my friends was walking into a store, and someone asked him, are you a Muslim? My friend said, yes. He said, tell me about Islam. So he talks to him. The man is sitting in his car. He talks to him about Islam, and the man becomes a Muslim. He takes his shahada right then and there. And then he notices someone is in the front seat. So he asked him, did you hear what I said? He said, yes. Did you like what I said? He said, yes. He said, what's preventing you from becoming a Muslim? The other person became a Muslim as well. And then we discover later on that he's actually, the person who became a Muslim is American football player. And quite popular as well. So he became a Muslim, alhamdulillah. But that was, he had only a 10-minute window, my friend, and he explained Islam to him briefly. But that was enough for that person to become a Muslim without reading Bukhari and reading the entire Qur'an. Why? This is what we're going to look at as well, inshallah. So we said da'wah is characterized by sometimes you have a little time. You don't have enough time to spend hours with everyone. So you have to have a quick and efficient way. I want to invite you to feel free to take and reject from some of the things that I say. I only have two rules that I insist upon adamantly. Beyond that, da'wah is very situational. A lot of times you meet du'at who want to put rules for you. But that's not the case. Da'wah is very situational. And how I speak to someone depends on a lot of things. It depends, first of all, how well I know that person. It depends on what they think of me. It depends on how old they are. It depends whether they're male or female. It depends what kind of setting I'm in. If I'm in a quiet room, I speak a different way. If I am in the middle of a rally, I will speak in a different way as well. So da'wah is situational. And unfortunately, we have a lot of people who make rules. And likewise, we have people who want a formula. So people always come to me looking for a magical formula. Brother Kamal, I know someone and this is the situation, what do I say? And they want me to say, first say this, then say that, the third he'll take his shahada. But that's not the case. And a lot of times I tell people, I can't tell you that because I don't know how well you know that person, I don't know the temperament of that person, I don't know how much knowledge they have, how much knowledge they don't have. So it's very situational. And what we want to look at today, inshallah, is some of the ways to discover who you're talking to and then to tailor and to mold your talk based on that person that you're talking, that you're addressing. So then, what I've put together is what I thought to be one of the best approximation to a good way of giving da'wah from the Qur'an and from the sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ and from observation and for personal experience. And then to reinforce those methods with whatever we have available of studies and of the sciences. Now, with that being said, I must put a disclaimer out that because I'm giving the workshop doesn't mean that I am the best da'iyah or the most qualified da'iyah. We have people amongst us in our audience, and I don't want to overpraise them in the sight of Allah. We have a lot more experience than I do. On that same token, they may benefit from a few of my points, and I may benefit from some of your points, and I purposely will ask you for how you would respond to situations so that I may benefit from some of your points. For the purposes of our workshop, da'wah, when we use the word da'wah, we're referring particularly to calling the non-Muslims to Allah. Because da'wah applies also to calling Muslims back to Allah. But here particularly we want to refer to da'wah as calling the non-Muslims to Allah. And for our purposes, the person you're speaking to, will refer to them as the prospect, for lack of a better term. So the one you're calling to Islam, that's your prospect. So then the question is, does this work? And maybe you'll sit here for 6 hours and then go home and none of this works. Just a waste of money, you brought me all the way from the United States. That's a possibility, right? So, what I have to show for that at least are the success stories that we have. First of all, in our university, in George Mason University, we have a da'wah table that consisted of a big bowl of candy in the middle, and little pamphlets and booklets on the sides, and then two brothers sitting behind the table talking to each other about the importance of da'wah. Meanwhile, non-Muslims come, they look, oh, they find candy, they take candy, they walk away. And that was a da'wah table. No one pushing out pamphlets, no one speaking to people. That's it, people taking candy, walking away. We might as well just throw candy at people. But out of the mercy of Allah, despite this being the technique, in about 2 to 3 years, two people became Muslim. We gave the first ever version of this workshop at George Mason University in the middle of the semester. From the middle until the end, about 17 people became Muslim, including one of the instructors at the university. And then we've given it to another group and they started doing street da'wah and they got around 30 people to become Muslim within a month. There was a young man, he was around 15 years old, he took the workshop. The next day he sent me an email, so that he used the methods on one of my friends and he became a Muslim. There's another 18-year-old and he took the workshop. And every time I see him, I ask how he's doing and he doesn't even count the shahadas anymore. And this is an important thing, is that we don't want to get caught up in doing a head count. People count how many shahadas they have under their belt. And because of that, they do all sorts of obscure and strange things to ensure that they have a shahada so they can count that. How many shahadas do you have? I have 20. How many do you have? 34, brother. So it becomes this a challenge of how many shahadas I have, how many you have. But what is the real question? Real question is how many you retain. Sahih? You say shahada in the street and then you never see that person again. They need to remain Muslim and they need to start praying. Or what's the value of counting that shahada? So, with that, I begin, but I would like to just to diverge from the norm a little bit here, and I would like to just discuss four exercises with you, and that will give me an idea of where we stand, because stereotypically, we in America think of you Brits as very, very well read and very. So I feel like maybe I shouldn't even be here. You know, this is a stereotype that we have. So we'll get some of your responses to some of these exercises here. We'll just take four examples, inshallah. Okay, if you'll read the first one, please. And think of a response. Or for the sake of time, let me just start. This is the situation. This is an actual situation that happened. Non-Muslim said that there's nothing wrong with fornication. There's nothing wrong with it. And both people agree to it. So it shouldn't be reprehensible, anything of that sort. So the Muslim used the argument of the Prophet ﷺ with the young Sahabi. Sorry. So he tells him, would you like that for your mother? Would you like that for your sister? The man says, yes, they agreed to it. What's the problem with that? So the question there in the bottom, this is a da'wah technique of the Prophet ﷺ. Why didn't it work in this situation? It worked for the Prophet ﷺ. Why didn't it work in this instance? Who would like to respond to that? Sisters, brothers? Yes, sir. Okay. Excellent. Very good. So that's it. That's how simple it was. The brother is saying that the Prophet ﷺ uses example on a Muslim. He uses comparison on a Muslim who has ghira, who understands obedience to Allah, who understands submission, who understands the need to worship Allah Azza wa Jal. So that's why it worked on him immediately. But you're now using a technique used for a Muslim, you're trying to apply that to a non-Muslim. And that's why it didn't work. You need to go a little deeper and build a little bit more foundation before you can come and use this argument. Anyone would like to mention anything else? Yes, sir. Excellent. Excellent. Very good. Very good. The brother is saying that you have to tailor your response based on the person. You have to bear in mind cultural differences and other differences. And sahih. And for example, the Arab in particular, they have or the Muslims back then, they had a lot of ghira. And even back then, they used to comment on the Westerners that they didn't have ghira. This type of jealousy over their women. This is one of the early things when they first come in contact. So, also, you have to address that. People will typically know ghira or little ghira, and you're trying to come to them from that angle. Okay, we'll take another one. A Christian asks you, isn't God capable of doing anything? Then why couldn't he have a son if he wanted to? Now, what is a simple response that you can just get them to think about this issue differently? I'm sure you're familiar with these questions. How would you respond to that? Yes, sir. Sorry? Okay, so the brother's taking it very logically. He says you need a partner to beget. Okay, very good. That will work. All these responses are correct. Anyone else?
In a class, he got everything in this world and what's in between them. Uh-huh. Or he doesn't need.
Okay. So then there's another logical angle. Allah doesn't need a son. Like for example, for human beings it's a sign of strength to have many children that will bear your name and so on. But for God, it's not the same situation. He doesn't need anyone to carry on any name or legacy or to... Na'am. Yes, sir.
You get to the son as the attribute of the creation. And he's a creator, which is different to the creation. So
what if they come back at you and say, I mean, you're right. What if they come and say, yeah, but... if he wanted to, he could have had a son. He's capable of doing it. So don't tell me the Trinity doesn't exist. He's capable of having a son. Khalas, it's over. So you can argue a simple logic here. You can ask people, and this sometimes it works. It's a very simple arguments, and everything that you said is correct so far, you ask someone, is God capable of stealing? Is He capable of lying? And immediately they think, oh, this doesn't make sense. We wouldn't accept that or expect that of God, that He would steal, that He would lie. Because Allah only does things that befit His majesty. And you know that question with the rock, you know? You've heard that? Can God create a rock that is so huge that no one can ever move it? You ask this to most people, tell you yes. Then you ask them, can God move the rock? And they say yes. So that means He can't create a rock that no one can. You understand the argument? But it's ridiculous. Because we're talking about human things, moving rocks and putting things aside. Allah Azza wa Jal only does things that befit His majesty. So stealing, lying, and having children, all these things do not befit the majesty of Allah Azza wa Jal. Okay, this one. So a revert, someone who became Muslim, but he was very offended by a copy of the Noble Quran printed in Saudi Arabia. The person who helped them become Muslim made it a rule, never give this copy out to people. What's wrong with this? It's very simple. You'll find, inshallah, that always the most simple. Naam?
Was the commentator wrong itself?
No, the comment was not incorrect. It's just the person found it offensive. But the person made it a rule, do not ever, ever give a copy of this Quran to anyone. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with it is that it's based on just one situation. No study was done, no survey was done. Just based on one situation. You can't make a rule from one particular situation. You have hundreds and thousands of people who have become Muslim and they've read that copy. Now just because one person was offended, you make it a rule to discredit and to just absolutely get rid of the entire publication. You see the argument? But you'll see this as a pattern. Every time someone has one experience, they make it a rule for da'wah. I spoke to one person, I gave this example, he didn't like it, that means don't use this example. No, it's not the case. That's one situation. You don't build a rule based on one. You don't go from the specific to the general, you go from the general to the specific. Correct? Alright, I think I have one more that I wanted to do. Naam?
Just double check. With that example there, it also would mean that kind of going towards the Christian footsteps where they split their Bibles into different versions. So by saying that, you're also trying to, of course, split between the Quran.
JazakAllah khair. The brother is learning from the Christian experience. And the minute we start doing that, the minute we start having so many versions and this is not acceptable, and it just won't work. Okay. One more. Okay, again, two Muslims discuss whether or not people become Muslims from listening to Islamic nasheeds. I don't know if you have that here, but basically they have a concert and there'll just be people singing nasheeds on. And then, okay, if you want to do that for fun, that's fine, but most people want to specifically call this a da'wah event. So, one person said, yes, people become Muslim from listening to nasheeds, non-Muslims. And he witnessed one accepting Islam at an Islamic concert. You know, those groups come and saying he saw one person become a Muslim. So he concludes that yes, people become Muslims from listening to Islamic nasheeds. What's wrong with this conclusion? You all know the answer, just simple logic. We're not talking here. Anyone? Sisters? JazakAllah khair. I love that argument. The brother is saying there's no such thing as Islamic concerts. Okay, I'll accept that. But beyond that, yes, sir. Yes, you. Afwan? Bid'ah. Barakallah fiqh. I'll also accept that. Yes, brother. Exactly. It doesn't mean this is the only reason. First of all, you have to think of it logically. Do non-Muslims just flock to non-Muslim concerts? And it's not like it's Michael Jackson. Oh, what's that other group? Rehan? Rehan is in town. Let's go. Non-Muslims come. Just listen to Rehan. That's not... The fact that this person came to this concert, it means that he probably has a Muslim friend who's been talking to him for a while. He became interested in Islam for a while. What are the other variables? What are the other factors that led them to become Muslim? Maybe they read half the Quran before coming to this concert. Maybe they've been going to masajid and learning and they had friends or they live with Muslim roommates, but they just happened to take their shahada on the stage. So how do you just conclude that they took their shahada because of this song that said we have to pray, we have to be good? You see? So this is just basically I'm trying to look at how, unfortunately with da'wah, we like a lot of us, we have engineers, we have scientists, but when it comes to da'wah, we're not scientific at all. We just haphazardly, everything happens. And we need to be systematic and we need to study things in more detail. So now from there we'll move inshallah to the original workshop. Okay. And that is, I don't know if you can see the bottom line there. Can you see that? That's my, or you have it there with you. So that's my contact information, where I would like that you send me the good news of what you have done after the workshop, inshallah. So some of, just a few, and there are many ayat in the Quran speaking of da'wah, but we just take a few here. In the first verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَمَا أَنْتَ بِهَادِ الْعُمْيَ عَنْ ضَلَالَتِهِمْ إِن تُسْمِعُ إِلَّا مَنْ يُؤْمِنُ بِآيَاتِنَا فَهُمْ مُسْلِمُونَ. So here in this verse, Allah is saying, you cannot guide the blind from their straying. You can only cause people to hear, إِن تُسْمِعُ. So that means your job basically, to get people to hear and to believe or to see the ayat of Allah Azza wa Jal. And in the end, they submit. We're going to break this down in more detail. But you see that your job is to make people hear and know what the truth is. And some people think our job is beyond that. And because of that, it becomes an obstacle to them. And the next verse, a famous verse for da'wah, وَمَنْ أَحْسَنُ قَوْلًا مِنْ مَنْ دَعَى إِلَى اللَّهِ وَعَمِلَ صَالِحًا وَقَالَ إِنَّنِي مِنَ الْمُسْلِمِينَ. That it's the ayah is put in the form of a question, but it's actually a rhetorical question. Allah is saying, who is better in speech? And what it means is that no one is better in speech than the one who calls to the way of his Lord. Notice that the person calls to the way of his Lord. So when you're calling to Allah. And it's not for your own self, it's not to make yourself look better or to build a reputation. Clearly for Allah Azza wa Jal. And for that reason, if someone refuses or someone doesn't become a Muslim or if someone insults you in the process of your giving them da'wah, you're not offended because you weren't doing it for you. You were doing it for Allah Azza wa Jal. How did I go back? That's strange. I know you drive on the left, but I didn't know also the mouse goes backwards on PowerPoint. Okay. You know that whoever, the Prophet ﷺ said, whoever guides another person to a good deed will get the same reward as the one who performs it. So, if you teach someone salah, every time they pray you get reward for teaching them salah. What if they take what you taught them and they teach it to 10 other people? Every time those 10 pray, you get the reward. And what if those 10 go and teach it to 5 and the 5 go and teach it? You keep getting reward. And that's why when you read of the, in the tafsir of Surah Al-Kawthar, Al-Kawthar is something that's a good, that's great in abundance, in quality and quantity. Some scholars say this is the reward of the Prophet ﷺ. Because as long, until the Day of Judgment, as long as someone is making tasbih, or dhikr, or salah, or salam, the Prophet ﷺ gets reward for that. Because he's the first one that taught us this. So the reward keeps multiplying. And the Prophet ﷺ said, لَإِنْ يَهْدِيَ اللَّهُ بِكَ رَجُلًا وَاحِدًا خَيْرٌ لَكَ مِنْ حُمْرِ النِّعَمِ or خَيْرٌ لَكَ مِنَ الدُّنْيَا وَمَا فِيهَا. That if Allah were to guide one person through you, it would be better for you than the red camels. The red camels were considered to be the best of wealth. And in another narration, مِنَ الدُّنْيَا وَمَا فِيهَا, than the whole world and everything that's in it. So if we really took this to heart, we would be giving non-stop da'wah. So why then that still people believe that it's so difficult to present people with Islam, it's so difficult to get people back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the reason is, they need to understand and differentiate between the types of hidayah, the types of guidance. You notice in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells the Prophet صلى الله عليه وسلم, إنك لا تهدي من أحببت ولكن الله يهدي من يشاء. You do not guide those whom you love, but Allah guides whomever He pleases. And then in another verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells the Prophet ﷺ, وَإِنَّكَ لَتَهْدِي إِلَى صِرَاطٍ مُسْتَقِيمٍ, and verily you guide to the straight path. So how is it? One ayah, you don't guide, in another ayah, you do guide. And the scholars explain that there are two types of guidance. There is hidayatul irshad, or hidayah irshadiyah, and hidayatul tawfiq, or hidayah tawfiqiyah. And in the first type, this is your job. It's just to tell people what the truth is, to direct them to the truth. Just explain to them what the truth is. That's all your job is. The second part of Allah opening their hearts to Islam, it's up to Allah Azza wa Jalla. When you understand this distinction, everything becomes easy for you. And inshallah you can move mountains. Because all you have to do is just speak clearly and directly about what the truth is, and the rest is up to Allah. And because of that, you'll never feel that there is an obstacle. For example, I would want to talk in the past to people, and a friend would tell me, oh, that person looks difficult. Don't waste your time. What's difficult? Me speaking to them? Speaking is not difficult. Okay, so I can direct them to the truth. Whether they accept or not is up to Allah. And is anything difficult for Allah? No. So from there on, this is your job, part one. The confusion is people think part two is their job. So when they speak to someone, and that person doesn't become a Muslim immediately, they feel, oh, I'm a failure at da'wah. So everyone understand these two points? Anyone want to ask anything or comment on this slide before we move on? Alright. So then what are the obstacles to you getting a shahada, to someone becoming a Muslim while you're speaking to them? And some of these obstacles are internal, meaning they deal with us, and some of them are external, dealing with the people that we're speaking to. So one of the problems we have is we expect instant results. Everyone, you want to speak to someone and you want an instant result. That you speak to them and while you're speaking, their beard starts to grow and they become Muslim immediately. But that's not the case. Sometimes you speak to someone and they're arguing with you, and it seems like they're not accepting any of your arguments. We had a friend like that. When we would speak to him about Islam, he would argue adamantly, refusing. And then he became a Muslim after a while, and he admitted. He said, when I used to argue with you, I was convinced 100%. But I just didn't want to lose the discussion. Didn't want to lose the argument. You see? So outwardly, he was arguing, he looked angry, but inwardly he believed every word that was said to him. So don't expect instant results. Maybe sometimes you'll speak to someone and it'll be years later, or months, before it clicks with them and they become a Muslim. Or maybe they will never become Muslim, but they become sympathetic with Muslims. Maybe someone had some misconception about Islam, you spoke to them, and they started to appreciate or accept Muslims. You know, and Allah can bring a degree of victory to His religion through a wicked person. You know, it could be a politician that you explain Islam well to them and they start to like it, or they understand it better. So don't expect necessarily that the result has to be the person taking the shahada immediately at the end of your talk. The second thing is people put this barrier for themselves. They say, I don't have enough knowledge. I need knowledge myself, so I can't go out and teach people. And this is also just a mental block, because realistically, everyone in this room, inshallah, you have the basic knowledge required for you to call yourself a Muslim. Basic knowledge about Allah Azza wa Jal and His Prophets. And that's enough knowledge to go out and give da'wah with. Abu Bakr Siddiq radiallahu anhu, when he became a Muslim, what did he do? He immediately went out and started calling people to Islam. And he brought into Islam 5 out of the 10 given glad tidings of paradise. It's a good quality here. 5 out of the 10 given good glad tidings of paradise came into Islam because of Abu Bakr. But at that moment, how much knowledge did he have? Was there even that much knowledge at the point? Were there ahkam for salawat and all these fiqh issues? They didn't exist. Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu took what he had of simple knowledge and basic knowledge, and he went and called people with that little knowledge to Islam. And people accepted. So don't tell yourself, I don't have enough knowledge. And by the way, you're not going to be asked difficult questions by non-Muslims. They just ask you, you know, why are we here? Why did Allah create us? And why this and why that? They're not going to come to you and say, you know, I want you to give me all the comments of the scholars of all the four madhahib on this particular fiqh issue. They're not going to tell you that. They're going to ask you very simple questions. So you do have enough knowledge. The third thing is sometimes a lot of people tell themselves, oh, I need da'wah myself, so how could I go out and give da'wah to others? And the reality is you're not going to ever one day wake up and say, okay, let me check level of iman, 100%, knowledge, 100%, I'm ready to give da'wah now. If you keep waiting for that day, the scholars say two things. One, you'll keep waiting until you go to your grave. Two, if you wake up one day and say, yes, iman, 100%, knowledge 100%, I'm ready to give da'wah. They say when that happens, know that you have gone astray. So that means then, as one da'i put it very nicely, he said if you have a handkerchief and you want to wash that, so you're using your hands, you're washing your handkerchief. He says you apply water, you apply soap, you check it, you apply, you wash again. At the end of the process, are your hands cleaned or not? Your hands are clean. Was your intent to wash your hands particularly? Not really, but they became cleansed in the process. And when you give da'wah, it rejuvenates and it replenishes your iman. And that's why you have, in some schools, when they have the da'wah table, you find all the Muslims there and they're giving da'wah. It makes them feel good themselves and increases their iman. So actually the opposite. Don't say, well, I don't have enough iman, or I need da'wah myself, therefore I can't give da'wah. Give da'wah and inshallah it'll help you improve yourself, inshallah. Number four, people say, I'm too shy. Always, people, I'm too shy to give da'wah. And there's certain remedies to that. One of them is that, first of all, you go out to da'wah, whether it's a table at an organization or university, or you in the streets during an event. You go, you know, with a group, and you encourage one another. But it's really like jumping into a cold swimming pool. It just takes a few seconds, and you're used to it. And even I myself, when I haven't been in the street for a long time, I feel awkward in the beginning. Okay, now I have to start getting in people's faces, pushing pamphlets and calling people. And at the beginning, it's embarrassing. So you call the first person, you call the second, the third, then it's okay, it's over. So the shyness is just temporary. So don't let that be an obstacle. The fifth possible obstacle is not knowing who you're talking to. And that's very important. You need to know who you're addressing. And for me, this was a big obstacle when I arrived in the US like 10 years or 9 years ago. I thought everyone I spoke to was a Christian who believed in Trinity. And I would just start immediately speaking based on that. And then people would stop me. No, I don't believe that. I don't believe that. So you need to know who you're talking to. And what we'll be discussing later on, inshallah, are certain ways and certain questions to ask to know immediately who you're talking to. That will save you a lot of time. See, I approach someone. I want to know, in the smallest number, in the shortest period of time, I want to know who they are, what their belief is, but I also don't want to give them the floor. Like one brother, and that's why I always say, use close-ended questions, yes or no questions. So I come to someone, and this is one brother, this is what he uses. He comes to people, he's giving them da'wah. He says, what's your view on God? It's basically, you're saying, let me pull up a chair, have the microphone, start lecturing to me. And the man was, I think he was started in 1962, or was it 67, when I first experienced, no, you're giving them the floor. You need to ask simple questions, very quickly you need to discover who you're talking to, tailor your talk accordingly, find out what the problem is, ask them to become Muslims. So, instead of me saying, what's your view on God, I can ask someone, do you believe in a creator, you believe there is a God? He says, yes. Do you believe that he sends prophets? He says, yes. If he says, no, We'll have to convince him to that point and then keep building on. And we're getting to the details of that. So know who you're talking to. There are certain questions and certain ways to quickly discover who it is that you're talking to. And therefore you save a lot of time and you tailor your talk accordingly. So why does this go back when you hit the... Usually it goes forward. Okay, thank you, sir. Sometimes the obstacles are not from our end. So we've taken care of all the other things we've discussed. Now the obstacle is on the end of the prospect. Yes, sir.
I was going to say there's also a disturbing trend I've noticed amongst some brothers.
Yes.
That they look at the non-Muslims in a very hostile, disdainful manner. They actually look at them and they almost say that, you know, these people, they're going to hell. They just...
Do those people typically go out and give da'wah?
That's what I'm saying. They don't go out.
They don't. Okay. So, excellent. So then the brother's adding something, and you can add that to your notes, please. That some people have that hostile attitude towards the non-Muslims. You know, that just let them go into the hellfire, as they would say. But sahih, that is an obstacle as well. And by the way, these slides, they're not written in stone. That's why I ask you, if there's always a point you can add, just raise your hand. Sister's also welcome. Unless that's not the norm here. Sister, speak here or what? Okay, good. So now we're talking about obstacles from the side of the prospect. I'm talking to someone and they might have certain obstacles that will prevent them from becoming Muslims. And these are just examples. That's not everything that's a potential obstacle. But for example, a lot of times you find people looking for a sign. And I don't know if your audience here is similar to the audience we have in the US. Because typically there you find people more religiously orientated, maybe, perhaps, than being atheistic, as I understand is what you deal with here. You agree with that? Okay. So a lot of times people, especially in a predominantly Christian society, even if someone is an atheist in a predominantly Christian society, they more or less tend to want a strong sign. And you'll see this in their movies and in their cartoons and in their books, that people ask, you know, give me a strong sign, Lord, or give me a sign, God, that I should do this. And even Muslims living in Western societies are affected by that. When they make istikhara, they expect a sign, they expect a clear dream. You heard that? I made istikhara, didn't get a dream. Who said anything about a dream? If you look at du'a istikhara, there's nothing about dreams in it. But people want signs, strong, clear signs. So that means then, that's a possible obstacle. I'll give you an example. One day I went to pray Dhuhr at an Islamic center in our area. So as I enter, there is a Caucasian American. He's walking out and he's got a bunch of books in his hand. And the whole staff, the entire staff of the center is walking out behind him. They're walking him to his car and everyone's like, bye, have a nice day. Okay, so I said, what's going on? He said, well, I just came to get some books on Islam. I'm giving you more or less exactly what I said to the person. So he said, he's just getting books on Islam. I said, okay, how have you read about Islam? He said, yes, I've been reading about Islam for a while. I said, what did you dislike about it? He said, absolutely nothing. I've been reading about it for a year. I like everything about Islam. So what does that tell me? If you like everything about the religion, what's keeping you from becoming a Muslim? And I made a guess. I thought to myself, this is what it looked like to me, this person likes everything about Islam and he's not becoming a Muslim. You know why? Probably he's waiting for a strong sign, a signal that will tell him now is the time. That's what he's probably waiting for. I made that guess. It could have been any other obstacle, but I, based on what I said to him, I figured that's probably the obstacle. Let me explain how the signs work to him and then we'll see. So I told him, you know what I think? This is more or less what I told him. I think you're looking for a sign. But you got your sign. Because notice in Surah Al-Ra'd, Allah says, إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَآيَاتٍ لِقَوْمٍ يَتَفَكَّرُونَ. In another verse, لِقَوْمٍ يَعْقِلُونَ. Allah Azza wa Jalla says, verily in these things are signs for people who contemplate and for people who consider. So that means the signs of Allah, you need to focus on them. It's not like the signs of Allah, they're like a neon sign. Everyone will see it and that's it, they'll understand it. So Allah puts many signs on earth, but we need to do what? To understand. We need to focus on them. We need to contemplate and to consider. And many signs of Allah, like for example, Allah will destroy a nation because of their shirk. But as a sign, He'll leave us what? Their buildings and their writings. And we can decipher and find out the gods they used to worship. So then we have a clear sign from Allah. But what happens to people? They go there, they get their picture taken. They don't consider it as a sign. People go to the pyramids, they get their pictures taken. They go to Mada'in Salih, which is now in Saudi. And you know what the Prophet ﷺ, when they were on the way to Tabuk, they rushed through it, they didn't drink from there, they didn't leave individually out in the open. It was, and the Prophet ﷺ said, if you pass through these areas, pass through as you're what? As you're crying. But now what happens? Tour buses go, people smiling, taking their pictures in front of Madain and Salih. So it's a sign of Allah, but people are not paying attention to it. Okay. So then, that means you need to get people to realize that they're probably just waiting for a sign. And I don't know if you deal with this a lot here, but it's good to bear it in mind. So this person, I told him that, look, you've been reading about Islam for a full year, and you have found absolutely nothing wrong with the religion. So it seems to me you're waiting for a voice, a deep voice to tell you to become a Muslim, or a beam of light in the middle of a dark room, or a clear sign. But the signs of Allah are very subtle. So Allah has already given you His sign. There are millions of people who hate Islam, or they believe what they see on television about Islam, and they just have this animosity towards the religion. And of all these people, Allah chose you to love His religion for a full year. You found absolutely nothing wrong with it. That's your sign. Don't expect anything else. I say, and this is exactly what I told, I say, become a Muslim right now, and you have the rest of your life to read these books and others. And you know what he said? He said, okay. Made sense to him. So he becomes a Muslim, alhamdulillah. So signs are an obstacle. There was another time we were at an Islamic convention, and there was a non-Muslim in the room, and they told me she was interested in Islam. So I went to speak to her. And we spoke about, is there a creator? She said yes. Okay. We spoke about the Prophet, she said yes. Prophet ﷺ, was he a prophet of Allah? She said yes. So then everything was there. We spoke about the five pillars. Make sense? Yes. So now, become a Muslim right now. No. Still not ready. So, now, any time someone says no, they don't want to become Muslim, obviously, there's a reason. So what you have to do, you don't just walk away, you have to discover what the problem is. What are some of the easiest ways to discover what the problem is? Ask them. Jazakallah khair. Just ask them, just like that. Very direct. So a lot of times we'll tell people, like, I explain Tawheed, no problem there. I explain the Prophets, no problem there. I explain the pillars, no problem there. In the end, will you become Muslim? No, I won't. That means there's a problem. So how do I discover? I ask. Okay. What is preventing you from becoming a Muslim right here and now? Tell me. Just like that, ask them. Because I explained to you the basics, we agreed on the fundamentals of the religion, we agreed on the pillars, and you still refuse, there's something else, what is it? Just like that. And then it'll come to you, oh, I have a fiancé who won't accept it, I have a family who won't accept it. So that's it. You discover exactly what the problem is. Ask, the best way. So like I said, this lady, explained everything to her, we were in agreement, but she refused to become a Muslim. And then I asked to see what the obstacle is, and she didn't have an excuse. There was no reason. So I thought to myself, she's probably waiting for a clear sign to say, become a Muslim. This clear sign from God to become a Muslim. And you know the visions and signs in Christianity. Paul, when he was on the road to Damascus, he had the vision. And Emperor Constantine also has a vision. So these visions, they have some weight. And people wait for that. So I said, she's probably waiting for a sign, a clear sign to tell her to become a Muslim. But that doesn't make sense if you agree with everything. So then I told her, look, now I explained to her that the signs of Allah are very subtle. Her name was Adrian. I said, now, if Allah was going to send you a sign, would you to become a Muslim, would you expect to be walking down the street, then you see a big neon sign that says, Adrian, become a Muslim now. Would you expect to see that? She laughed. She said, no. I said, would you expect the signs of Allah maybe to be a little subtle? She said, possibly. I said, maybe like a short, annoying man telling you to become a Muslim. She said, possibly. Yeah. So then I said, you will not find anything phenomenal about what I'm saying. Very simple. I said, how many Muslims are in this room? It was a big convention, it was a bazaar. She said, thousands of Muslims in this room. I said, how many non-Muslims do you think are in this room? She said, probably just me. I said, how many non-Muslims outside of this room? She said, billions. I told her, out of the billions of non-Muslims, Allah chose you and put you amongst thousands of Muslims in this room, and you have been interested in His religion for a year, and everything in His religion makes sense to you, and you cannot come up with any excuse to not become a Muslim, and you're waiting for another sign? So do you think she became Muslim after that? No, it's not magic. Yeah. But in the end I told her, look, I spent a while. In the end I told her, look, I have to leave. I'm going to give you 3 seconds, I'm leaving. 3, 2, 1, I started walking away. She said, oh, you're just going to leave me like that? So she called me back, and then she did become Muslim, alhamdulillah, in the end. So, but you understand now, obstacles, obstacles, obstacles. You need to understand what is the obstacle. It could be misconceptions about Islam that they've heard, news, television, books, or something about the Muslims that they misunderstood. You need to find out what that is. And a lot of times people will express that to you quite quickly. Why does Islam allow this? Or Islam permit that? And all these questions that you get. A lot of people believe, number three, that problems are caused by religion. So people tell you, I'd like to tell you in a few minutes I'll explain to you about Islam. No, I don't talk about religion. And then I don't know if you hear this, but we always hear this. More people die because of religion than because of anything else. Have you heard that? How would you refute that? Is that true, first of all? It's absolutely false. It's not true. Do the math. You'll find that more people die because of other things. If you want to call them secular wars, they're usually about land and money. World War II alone, the second great war. I don't believe it was a world war. I call it the second great war. 23 million people died. It had nothing to do with religion. It had something to do with some type of deviant ideology. But 23 million people died in the second great war. Not counting the first great war, the Hundred Years' War, the Prussian War. All these wars, it's Napoleon aimlessly from the Alps and going down to Egypt. He got a million of his own men killed, of his soldiers, directly. Not counting the millions who died of other soldiers and millions who died indirectly because of his pillaging and murdering. Thousands, millions of people died because of land and fighting over money. And sometimes we don't know the reason. Compare that then, do the math there, to how many people die because of religion. The question then becomes is, do people really die only because of religion? So if there is a war that had a religious taint, is it only because of religion? You understand where I'm going? For example, the Crusades. A lot of times from the European side, they used Christianity to get people to join the armies. And they would even have people draw images of Muslims desecrating holy Christian sites. They would show that to people. People would get upset, build crosses, get their arms, and join the army by hundreds. So, even if religion is included in a war, for example, is it because of that religion? The example I give, and I don't know how sensitive you guys are over here, but for example, 9/11 is what I use as an example. I mean, of course, if you're not one of those who believe in the conspiracy theories, so let's suppose the 19 did it, right? Were they sitting in the masjid, suddenly they read a verse that says they have to do this? Or is there something else involved in the process? I also give the example of Jews and Palestinians, and I'm not trying to downplay Islamic groups and movements as just, you know, political. But for example, we have many Jews in New York City, and we have many Palestinians in New York City. Why didn't we hear that a Palestinian blew up a bus full of Jews in New York City? Why? Because it's not that you look in the Quran and there's a verse that says go kill Jews. So then why is there killing happening in the area of Palestine? Because there's what? Besides religion, what other factors exist? Political factors, land disputes. You see what I'm saying? What I'm trying to say in a nutshell is that even when people blame religion, you say this is because of religion, it's not really because of religion. There's something else mixed with it. Any bombing, any other any things that we all these things, reprehensible acts, they have something else mixed with them. If you question the person of the perpetrators, any of these attacks, it's not because, they won't tell you because of verse number this, this, and surah that. No, it's because they have some other issue involved. So it's not true that the wars and deaths are caused by religion. Actually, there are other things. So they don't tell you, I don't talk about money, more people die because of money, but just it's an excuse for religion. Sometimes people have, they're not able to become Muslim because of the influences of their family or their society. And you also have to find that out. So if you explain Islam to someone, you agree 100%, you ask them to become Muslim, they say no, ask. And then They might tell you, well, my family won't accept it. And sometimes people tell us, well, if I become Muslim, you know, my family will ostracize me, or they will not speak to me anymore. And unfortunately, this is my technique, and feel free to reject this. My technique, when people tell me that my family won't accept, I don't do that. Most people tell them, no, inshallah, they love you, they'll accept, it's not a problem. And then they go and it is a problem. So my technique is actually the opposite. I prepare them for the worst. So okay, well, this is how Allah tests you. Most likely you will encounter resistance. And maybe your family will get angry with you. Maybe they'll not speak to you. But how long do you think that will last? Maybe a month or two, maybe a few weeks. Eventually, they love you, they're going to come back to you. But the companions of the Prophet ﷺ, when they became Muslim, they were beaten, they were starved, they were whipped. They would make them lie down on red-hot coals. Khabbab ibn al-Arat, the eyewitness says, only the fat from his back would melt and extinguish the coals. So then I would ask them, you think you might have any relatives that might do that to you? Make you lie down on red-hot coals? So then they laugh. No. I tell them, okay, and this is just a test from Allah. Be strong if that happens to you. And that makes it more realistic for them. They tell them, oh, they will love you and they will accept you. Then they go home and they encounter resistance. Most people think problems with their religion apply across the board. That if there's a problem with Christianity, that's probably the same deal with every other religion. And you always hear, all books of religion were written by man. You hear that many times. People say, all these religions are man-made. All these religions have flaws. Okay. Well, how do you know that this applies across the board? This is one thing we learned from our Sheikh Ja'far Idris. He said when he was a young man, his professor used to say, all religions are man-made, all religions are this. Oh, so then Sheikh Ja'far put his hand up. He said, how many religions do you know in good detail? And the professor said, just Christianity. He said, then say Christianity is man-made. Christianity is, don't say all religions if you don't know all religions. But what I'm trying to say is, this is how people think. They find out that, for example, the Bible has flaws. Say, oh, well, all these books have flaws. You know, someone made up a lot of things in Christianity. Oh, all these religions are made up. So that's not the case. And this is an obstacle because people think the problems with their religion apply across the board. There's one of the early Americans, Thomas Paine, if I remember correctly. He wrote a tract called The Age of Reason. And it's very unreasonable, but he very accurately describes what's wrong with Christianity and the Bible. 100% accurate, no mistakes whatsoever. Then in the end, in the last two or three sentences, in one sentence he says, and the same applies to Islam. How did you know that? How did you come to this conclusion that the same applies to Islam? But this is how people think. There's a flaw with their religion, oh, that's how all religions are. Probably we need to stop in about a few minutes. So, the various da'wah methods that we're speaking about, and these are not any official terms, but these are just my descriptions. When we're doing pamphlet pushing, we're just trying to distribute da'wah material basically to an audience. Let's discuss that one. So you have, let's suppose it's a rally, for example. There are going to be, you know, a couple of thousand people expected to turn out at this rally. So we want to go out and give them material on Islam. So we break into groups, we have backpacks that we can replenish our supplies from, and we start passing out pamphlets to people. You try to have a plan where you can canvass the entire area. You don't waste time talking to each other. And a lot of times we go on da'wah events, and the brothers, especially the ones who are shy, they start talking to each other and not giving da'wah. You know, brother, yeah, we have, you know, we need to give da'wah, okay? Give da'wah. So, one of the things, like I was telling, I had the shahada that was under 10 seconds. What would you say about that? Because people complain about 10 minutes, under 10 seconds. I didn't even say any word. I'm that eloquent, by the way. I didn't say a single word. How? We're out in the Million Family March, passing out pamphlets. So this man is walking and I'm walking. He passes by me, I give him a pamphlet. I keep walking. I turn back, he stopped walking, he's reading it. I keep walking. I look at him, he's still in the same place. So I tell myself, should I go back to him? I'll go back to him. I walk back to him. Haven't said a word yet. I get there. He says, okay, what do I do now? I said, for what? He says, to become a Muslim. I kept telling him, you know, it's serious, it's not a joke. He said, yeah, I'm ready. So sometimes Allah will just put you in the path of someone searching for the truth. You don't have anything to do with it. You don't have to say anything. It could be a matter of minutes, it could be a matter of seconds. That's how simple it is. So, if then I can give a pamphlet to someone and he'll say, okay, what do I do next? That means every potential person is a potential Muslim. I mean, every person is a potential Muslim. So why would I waste time talking to someone where 50 people pass by? So, no talking, just passing out material. Now, one of the things I understand that you don't have this setting in your universities where you have a da'wah table. Is that correct? Na'am? You do?
Some,
okay. Is there a law preventing that? Okay. Because we're, at least we have it, that it's a rule. You have to have a da'wah table. Otherwise, what's the use? Even if it's just to distribute candy. But you have to have some kind of da'wah table. I think we should apply that here. It should always be a da'wah table. It should be during the same days of the week. For example, Tuesday, Wednesday, or every Wednesday from 12 to 4. And people that way also know where and when to find you, and they can come to you every time. So, what we want to do, we want to pass out pamphlets, but we also eventually want people to stop so we can start a dialogue. So, some good ways to get a dialogue started is to have a catchphrase. Something to arouse interest, something to get people to stop and talk to you. And this is the one I use, and feel free to use whichever one you like. So, I'm passing out pamphlets. Free information on the purpose of life. Purpose of life, to worship the Creator, alright? Free information on the purpose of life, free and beneficial. They say no. Thank you very much. Have a nice day. Free information on the purpose of life. We keep handing it out. My rule is you take it or you hear it. People need to know the purpose of life. If you take the pamphlet, inshallah, you will find out what it is. If you don't, let's say they refuse, I want them to hear it. Free information on the purpose of life. They say no. Thank you very much. And what is the purpose of life? To worship the Creator is the purpose of life. That's it. And you'll be amazed at how just a simple question, what is the purpose of life, shocks people. So we want people to stop. What is the purpose of life, sir? And sometimes they don't know what to tell you, and then you give them the answer. So we'll stop here with the pamphlet pushing. The last point, know what you're handing out. A lot of times we're going on a da'wah event, and brothers, give me one of the red, okay, I like the green one here. So they take pamphlets just based on color. So then they hand out the pamphlet to someone, and then the person asks them, what is this about? So what's the answer? Islam. Of course it's about Islam. So know what you're handing out. Know what the material is. Not all the material is good, by the way. A lot of times it's nice and glossy paper, but the content isn't that good. And sometimes it's not the best for the situation. For example, you've seen the pamphlet who practices polygyny. You've seen that one? Basically, it's about polygyny. I'm not going to walk around the street, give it to someone who's going to say, oh, well, how do I take my shahada? I like the sound of that. That might work, perhaps, if we're doing a seminar or an event on women in Islam and we're passing out pamphlets on women in Islam. You might include one on polygamy or polygyny in particular. But, so okay, we'll stop there. وسبحانك اللهم ربنا وبحمدك أشهد أن لا إله إلا أنت استغفرك واتوب إليك صلى الله على محمد وعلى صحبه أجمعين جزاكم الله خير السلام عليكم